The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Any reasonable person would think we're finally done with the question of whether Secretary Clinton violated the law. I mean, one thing that is not being stressed enough in this report is that there was no debate about this among the dozens and dozens of people dealing with it, both in the Department of Justice and the FBI. This was an easy case of declining prosecution, that it would have been a terrible deviation from history and from practice to do otherwise, in particular because, rightly or wrongly, the folks at the State Department who were sending her these emails and she did not realize they contained classified information.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 16th, 2018. This week, Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz released a gigantic report on the FBI's handling of the Clinton emails matter / investigation during the 2016 election cycle. It is a doozy, harsh, critical, and also validating in important respects. And it has been received as a bit of a Rorschach test, with everybody seeing in it exactly what they want to. We got together a group of people to talk about the whole report, not just the parts they want to talk about. Quinta Jurecic, Lawfare's managing editor, Carrie Cordero, former Justice Department official and Lawfare contributor, and Marty Lederman of Just Security and the Georgetown Law School. We talked about it all, and here it is. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 321, All Things Inspector General and Emails. All right, let's start with Gestalt reactions. This is a very large document, and it covers a huge amount of ground. And I think the first 24 hours of reaction to it have certainly shown it to be something of a Rorschach test. But Carrie, get us started. What were your overall reactions to the Inspector General's report?
So I'm about two-thirds of the way through it. I've read most of the parts that I think I need to read to have a good impression of it. I have to admit, it doesn't really change what my assessment has been all along. There's new details. There's certainly more inside information about the various conversations that took place between senior Department of Justice leaders and Director Comey, and sort of the inside thinking and machinations of what was going on behind the scenes. But as to whether or not he did the right thing in the summer, in his July statement, and in October of 2016, I don't necessarily think that anyone who's come to a view of those particular events necessarily will have any kind of changed view. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe that's just me, but I've always had a particular view about his July 2016 statement and a slightly different one regarding how he handled actions in October of 2016. What I think it does show is, for someone as a former Justice Department employee, you know, there always could have been better communication, better coordination. Sort of, you get the feeling that between the director and the deputy attorney general and the attorney general, that everybody was always kind of holding back on each other. and not really having the hard conversations about what needed to be done. They had conversations, but they never were able to come to mutual decision-making, and so then he went his own way.
Quinta, what are your big picture thoughts?
Yeah, I think I really agree with Carrie. It seemed more of a story about a big, complicated organization made up of a lot of people trying to do a very complicated job in a very difficult time. More than anything else, that came out the most to me in the story of why it took the FBI an extra month to take action on the emails that were found on the Wiener laptop, which is basically a story of everyone thinking that someone else is going to follow up, which I think is a story that's familiar to all of us. And so the top line conclusion of the report, obviously, was that political influence did not affect the conclusions of the investigation. There is a lot there about Comey's behavior that I think is broadly, not even broadly, it is consistent almost down to the word in Comey's testimony to what we knew before about what Comey's actions were. And what the report really does is sort of flesh out the bigger, sort of wider focus bureaucratic picture of what was going on around that.
Marty? Big picture thoughts?
So, before a big picture thought, just a couple of pushbacks, slight pushbacks on what Carrie and Quinto were saying. I don't think this describes an organization, especially the Department of Justice, that is broadly dysfunctional or beset by all sorts of problems. I think that it describes in extraordinary detail and careful detail particular problems with particular actors within the institution, and James Comey, most importantly of all, where the institution is otherwise working quite well, with another exception, which is the leaks, which we'll talk about a little bit later. A culture of leaks that is barely mentioned in the report, but what is mentioned is quite extraordinary. I'd also, I guess, disagree a little bit with Carrie's suggestion that this will just confirm everyone's pre-existing notions of whether what happened was right or wrong, mostly because it goes into great detail about exactly what the arguments were that led the director to do what he did in July and October of 2016, and which arguments he was not relying upon, and reveals the paucity of any justification for him having done what he did, in a way that I think is very telling and that will be very important as a sort of corrective going forward. But the big picture, in terms of the big picture, I guess I'd like to start by doing something that everyone expects me to do, which is to agree with President Trump's tweet this morning. Trump tweeted, "I did a great service to the people in firing James Comey." And I want to suggest that that is both fundamentally wrong in one sense, but right in a sense that the president has really no idea about how right it is and why. The reason which it's wrong, of course, is that President Trump didn't fire James Comey because of the reasons that Rod Rosenstein wrote in his memoir that Michael Horowitz has written in great detail in this report. Instead, he fired him for what appears to be an illegitimate reason, which is to try to shut down an investigation of himself, his campaign, and his close associates, something that is, you know, at least a violation of his constitutional oath, and certainly deeply inappropriate, as this report lets on. But more importantly, he did it because he thought that it would shut down the Russia investigation and sort of eliminate the ability of the Department of Justice and the FBI to give a full and fair account of what has gone on, and most importantly, what the threats are in the future with respect to Russia and American electoral systems. Whereas exactly the opposite has happened. Just as Richard Nixon, by having Archibald Cox fired during the Saturday Night Massacre in order to save his own skin, ended up just 11 days later with a special counsel who was far more independent and therefore far more effective and much more of a national consensus that led to Nixon's downfall. The firing of Comey, ironically enough, led to the appointment of Robert Mueller. And the biggest picture, I guess my big picture, the big ticket item here coming out of this report is the contrast between how Comey ran the investigation of the Hillary emails in 2016 and the way that Mueller is running his investigation now. The contrast is stark in many important respects. Mueller is doing it absolutely right, in, as far as we can tell. History will have to determine this, but as far as we can tell, doing everything very differently from the way James Comey did it, and therefore bringing, you know, not only salvaging the reputation of the department and of the Bureau, but actually doing his job the right way and the way it ought to be done. So for me, the biggest takeaway, so to speak, is the extraordinary contrast between the way these two investigative leaders ran their investigations.
Carrie, you said you started by saying that it didn't fundamentally change your view, but you didn't outline what your view was going into it, save to say that you viewed the July and October actions differently from one another. So lay it out. What are your priors here going into reading the report?
Sure. And just quickly to Marty's first point, I don't mean to suggest at all that the report paints a picture of a dysfunctional Department of Justice. What I think it does paint a picture, and it shows that it, at working levels and at senior leadership levels, sort of right beneath the principals, there was a lot of coordination and effort. What I think it does show is a failure of the director, the deputy attorney general, and the attorney general themselves personally to come to a meeting of the minds and to engage substantively enough to resolve it. But going back then, so the way that I have always, in my mind, distinguished the events, and there's I think most everybody disagrees with me about this, is I have always been much more willing to have an understanding of why Director Comey made the July 2016 statement. And I think part of it is because of the lack of engagement by the Attorney General, which I think is somewhat borne out by the Inspector General's report. In other words, I think that after the tarmac meeting, now there were obviously factors going in before the tarmac meeting, but if the report is correct that the tarmac meeting kind of put the Director Comey over the edge in terms of deciding to make the statement himself, I think the failure of the Attorney General at that time to make a definitive decision, that is, to either recuse, which according to the report she wasn't required to do, but to either recuse or to own the decision on the prosecutorial declination of the Hillary Clinton case. In my judgment, for the past year, the Attorney General failed to do that. And so by her saying, well, I'm just going to take the recommendation of the prosecutors, what that did is she basically sort of abdicated responsibility for the decision. And that decision on such a major case, it really ought to reside with the Attorney General. So on that point, I think the Inspector General's confirmation of what, frankly, most other observers probably agree with, which is that the director of the FBI usurped the authority of the Attorney General, I think is unfair because I think that it does not count enough the lack of engagement and definitive decision-making one way or another by the Attorney General. On the other hand, the October 2016 statement with respect to his letter and what he was trying to do with the Anthony Weiner laptop, I think because of the proximity to the election, that is much fairer ground to criticize the director's activity and public statements in that. And that one I have always found harder to defend.
Marty, you were shaking your head.
So Carrie and I read different reports, particularly when it comes to the accounts of the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General. I'm not certain, I'm not sure this is the best use of our time in this podcast to be rehashing that and deciding what happens, but just the broad strokes about what happened in July is that James, far from being disengaged, the Attorney General, and in particular the Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, was working hand in glove, as far as they could tell, with James Comey, where in a situation in which virtually everyone on the FBI side and the Department of Justice side thought that it looked as though it was a clear case for non-prosecution, that there was no mens rea and no criminal actions had been taken by Senator Clinton, and that that's where it was leading to. It wasn't, there were still a few loose ends to wrap up, and that they were working together. Comey had led Sally Yates to believe they were working together toward a declination announcement sometime in early July. All the while, Comey was plotting and actually drafting with his people a statement that he would make on his own. He actually deliberately misled the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General. He concedes as much because he knew that if he told them, that if he allowed them to be involved, he would not be able to make the solo announcement that he did, which was substantively deeply troubling, as Inspector General Horowitz concludes, and deeply misleading about the Clinton investigation, and that it violated all the norms of cooperation and lines of authority within the Department of Justice. It took the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General by surprise, and everyone else in the Department of Justice by surprise. The accounts of everyone watching Comey's press conference that day are that they are all aghast and in shock that this is happening. He didn't tell them it was happening until after he had already done a press release. There was virtually, and this was all planned 2 months before the tarmac incident between Clinton and Loretta Lynch, that Comey was planning to do this. It was an extraordinary deviation from norms. And it was not because Comey thought that either Sally Yates or Loretta Lynch was in fact compromised. In fact, to his credit, Comey says that he had no indication that they were, or that they were biased, or that they were unfair at all. So then that raises the question, why did he go to such extraordinary lengths to deceive them over 2 months and to blindside them on this final morning, and to cut them out of the loop? And his answer is, very candidly, that he was afraid that even though they were straight arrows and calling it as it ought to have been called, and Horowitz describes in detail, by the way, after Comey's press conference, that Attorney General Lynch had the sort of extended, substantive, you know, meeting with all the principals involved at the Bureau and then the department, and made the decision, that a consensus decision among the dozens of people on the investigation, that there was no justification, for bringing any charges. Why did he do it? Because he was afraid that some Republican critics would accuse the Attorney General of having made a declination decision that was biased or partisan, even though there was no justification, no basis for that kind of accusation. And that therefore, and the funny thing is that he says over and over and over again, I did it because it couldn't be, it would be, you know, unthinkable, or it would be subject to great dispute and accusations if a democratically appointed attorney general were to decline to prosecute a Democratic candidate. Well, James Comey was a democratically appointed officer, and Robert Mueller is appointed by the Republican, by a Republican DAG, and Rod Rosenstein by a Republican president. So that's really an extraordinary thing. I actually think that both Loretta Lynch and especially Sally Yates are vindicated by this report in most respects, although there are a couple of discreet and fairly taken criticisms of the Attorney General. So that's just my corrective to what I see as Kerry's account of all this. Important mostly not to correct the record or the historical record, but to get at the question of why did the, you know, what was problematic about deviating so acutely from the rules that were laid down within the department.
So I want to cover, you know, the report covers a huge amount of ground, and Comey's decision making is only part of it. The part of this report that the skeptics of the FBI and the skeptics of the Mueller investigation are spending a lot of quality time with involve two names that we'd never heard of before about 6-8 months ago, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. Quinta, what do you make of the findings about this culture in which a lot of FBI agents or some number of FBI agents are furtively sending each other text messages with a great deal of political content, And how do you think about that in the context of a broader report that says there's, you know, not a lot of evidence of the influence of people's politics in the conduct of the investigation?
Yeah, I think that, look, the text messages, they look bad. I mean, there's no nice way to say it. There are plenty of exonerating things that you can say, and which the report does say, which is that there's no evidence that the political leanings of Strucker Page or any of the other FBI employees whose messages are captured in the report affected the conclusion of the investigation in any way. But when you have two FBI employees texting and one tells the other, "We'll stop Trump from becoming the president," I'm paraphrasing here, it's a message that Strzok sent to Page. It just looks really terrible. And it's kind of astonishing to see that all written out, all in one place. The report's conclusion is essentially that, I think the phrasing is that it brings discredit on the FBI and on the investigation. And it's kind of hard to dispute that. That being said, it is also true, as I noted, that the report says that that didn't affect the conduct of the investigation. The only case in which the inspector general kind of hedges is on this question of Wiener's laptop. They essentially say that they can't rule out that Strzok might have slow-rolled it intentionally or unintentionally because he felt that the Russia investigation was more important. To be clear, that doesn't mean that they're saying that Strzok did slow-roll it, but they can't rule out that possibility, which I think really points to why these messages are so damaging.
Right. So let's talk. The report is not about political optics, but this aspect of the report has major political optics. And, you know, if the sum total of the report had been, you know, there's an investigation conducted on the merits and there's this mishigas at the top between the FBI director and the attorney general and deputy attorney general, and all there were to talk about is this question of whether there's any defense for what Jim Comey did or not, the report would be a bit of a dud, except for in the public eye, except for people like Marty who feel it's a very important statement of the, you know, with respect to the propriety of the way the FBI director conducted himself.
With respect to the institute, the value of the institutional rules that ought to be complied with.
Right. So look, I'm bracketing that issue for it. Right.
Right.
That issue has a very important audience, but it would not be driving wall-to-wall coverage on Fox News, right? And what will drive wall-to-wall coverage on Fox News is when an FBI counterintelligence official texts his girlfriend, "Don't worry, we'll stop him," right? And so, and because Strzok then goes from there to work for Bob Mueller on the Russia investigation, it has this carryover effect into the political delegitimization of the Mueller investigation. So, Quinta, you spend more time in the fever swamp of conservative Twitter than I do. How is this playing?
Yeah, I spend more time there than any person should. I think it's... There is an element of the Rorschach test to the report because the top line conclusion is this wasn't affected by politics. And then there's sort of, 500 pages of but. And so everyone gets to take the pieces that they like on. If you look on, Donald Trump Jr.'s likes, you can see he's very into the fact that Strzok sent. It's specifically the "will stop" message. I think Representative Jim Jordan said, that this was explosive, that it showed that the whole Mueller probe was illegitimate. And there's really a sort of campaign on the Trump supporting right at the moment that the president has kind of glommed onto, where somehow the conclusions of this report undermine the Mueller probe. It seems, as far as I can tell, the connection is Strzok's involvement there. It's a pretty weak read to hang all that on, but that's the sort of counter narrative that's being spun up.
Carrie, what do you think? Does this have staying power, or is this a kind of two-day blip that is caused by this single extremely unfortunate text message, and eventually, you know, by the time it rounds to zero in the larger conversation about the Mueller investigation?
I think that the Strzok and Page emails are always going to be bad, and they're always going to be there to cause damage to the FBI's reputation. They're always going to be used by political opponents of the investigation and political supporters of the president to attack the integrity of the FBI and the conduct of its leadership and the conduct of its investigations. So I think the fact that this report just includes more details about their texts just continues in that same narrative, that there really is no defending the use of their professional interactions to talk about their own personal political views. I think the report is very clear that it did not find any evidence that, despite their inappropriate communications on their government devices revealing their own political views, that that had any impact on the actual decision making in the investigation. And that point is going to get lost in the coverage of the particular text messages because the content of them looks really bad. But to that extent, the Inspector General has done a service by making clear that it conducted an exhaustive review, and that review did not reveal that, despite these beliefs that they had or their opinions, their political views, that that substantively impacted the investigation.
One of the other areas, Marty, that the report actually finds misconduct as opposed to, you know, errors like with the Anthony Weiner delay or, bad judgment as insubordination as with Comey. One of the discrete areas where the report actually finds that there's, you know, misconduct is with respect to this culture of leaks that it kind of describes in passing and then reserves for future, future investigations. But those few pages are pretty startling, and I'm interested in your thoughts on it.
Yeah, they really are. So just to put them in context, I do think that the report read as a whole, it's these things like the text messages, like the leaks, like Comey's refusal to abide by the usual rules in the lines of authority, and a couple of others stand out so starkly because the vast majority of the report describes the Department of Justice and a Federal Bureau of Investigation in which there are dozens of people just calling it the right way and doing it the right way and coming to a consensus.
And the other dozen on the phone with the press.
Right, right.
I'm joking.
But it shows how a few deviations from the norm can have such terrible impacts on what is otherwise an extraordinarily principled and thorough and good investigation, doing the things you want your public servants to be doing.
So one of them
is that, you know, he says almost in passing, Horowitz, it's really remarkable, he says the rules were pretty clear and correct, which is that there were only a very small handful of bureau officials who had the authority ever to speak to the media about ongoing investigations. And then he says, as it turns out, however, there was a culture of virtually everyone, dozens, literally dozens of FBI agents, in particular, he doesn't say, but many of the players in the story say, in the New York office, speaking constantly to the press about what's going on and leaking, to the point where he's got charts in the back. People at all levels of the FBI in such constant and frequent contact with the media that it's impossible for him to figure out who's leaked what, because it's endemic. And I guess I want to get back to the contrast The text messages weren't only embarrassing. They were completely inappropriate. And that's why Bob Mueller, when he found out about them, removed these people from the investigation. It's why Bob Mueller's investigation, as far as we can tell, is completely leak-free. They are doing it the right way. It's why Bob Mueller is working hand in glove with the deputy, with the acting attorney general, and taking every important step only after consulting with him and getting his approval to do so, abiding by all of the rules, not caring about what the Fox News swamp will say about things afterwards, not caring about the election, not making all of these terrible mistakes, but instead allowing the wonderful officials of both the Bureau and the Department to do the jobs they're trained to do and that they and that 98% of them do all the time. And so it's that contrast that, to me, really stands out.
Carrie, what did you make of the leaking discussion? And in addition, what did you make of the discussion of Andrew McCabe, who has sort of independent problems with the inspector general and his prior misconduct report with respect to him individually?
So on the leaking point generally, I share Marty's view that it is really, it is surprising sort of how pervasive the leaking problem was, although it doesn't really provide, I don't think, sort of the real details of who it was. I've always felt in the public discussion of this, sort of the media discussion of the leaks of the FBI, that there has been a inappropriate melding of information that was maybe coming from retired agents, particularly up in New York, versus what was actually coming from active workforce themselves. And part of this is because some of the cable networks have a number of former retired agents that are out on them. And so I've always felt that that piece has gotten mixed together. The report does seem to say that there was actual leaking from active agents who were involved. And so it looks like the director was trying to take steps to stem it. I do think it is an indication, and the comparison that Marty makes to the Mueller investigation is actually instructive. My time in the Bureau, my time at the Justice Department and working with the Bureau, having married up to Director Mueller's tenure, Director Mueller and Director Comey have very, very different leadership styles. And obviously, Director Comey has written his book about his leadership style, but his leadership style is not one of fear, and he went out of his way to not be feared. He was respected, I think, by most of the FBI workforce. Some really loved him. Mueller, on the other hand, was deeply respected, and I would suggest that he was feared, that if somebody did something wrong, they were really going to feel the consequences of his direction towards them. And I wonder whether that aspect of leadership allowed this more loosey-goosey relationship with the media that I just don't think took place under Mueller's tenure. And on Andy McCabe, I think that this report, and I read the original Inspector General report on Andy McCabe as well. I'm probably on a minority view on this, but I really think that Andy McCabe has been treated to some extent unfairly through all of this. I think that the allegation of lack of candor that was demonstrated, that was outlined in the Inspector General report about him, really came down to a he said regarding the recollection of how different authorizations were made in different discussions. I think that he faced a tremendous amount of turmoil in the time that he was the acting director, and so his not following up on various aspects of questions he was being asked during the time after Director Comey was fired, I think, are understandable. And I think that the decision to fire him based on the one set of facts alone pertaining to his authorization of FBI employees to talk to the media did not take into account the incredible record of service that Andy McCabe had throughout his entire career. And I think it's very hard to look at what happened to Andy and not see some differences between how individuals who were political appointees have weathered the storm versus how the individual who was a career employee has weathered the storm.
In all of that, Carrie, is from the IG's prior report. Andy McCabe's role in this seems very standard, very deputy director-like. How do you understand the contrast between the two?
Well, in this report, I think one of the most important points that is made about Andy McCabe is that when he was the assistant director of the Washington Field Office and his wife was running for state office, he consulted with the ethics advisors and the FBI. Now, this report actually faults the ethics advisors not for the actual advice that they gave him, which is that he didn't need to recuse from anything at the time, but that they didn't sort of appreciate the full scope of the impact of what was going on and that they should have done more follow-up and paid more attention and maybe given him better and more timely advice. Other than that, there are some statements in this report that indicate that once he did recuse, which was very close to the election, November, I think he officially recused around November 1st, 2016. Once he did recuse, there was a little bit of confusion about sort of what phone calls he was on and whether he was fully extricated from things. But I don't recall whether this report says that his recusal was in writing or sort of exactly how it manifested itself. But other than that, it looks like he was engaged in the way that one would expect the deputy director to be engaged, and that there were all sorts of, you know, you got to remember, in investigations, it's not like there's scheduled meetings all the time about one investigation. Sometimes there are, but sometimes if it's a meeting between the director and the deputy and the entire sort of leadership team, they're going through multiple cases at the same time. And so Andy was involved in those. And I don't think there's anything in this report that shows that he acted in any bad faith or did anything that I see that rises to the level of what he has experienced.
So I want to throw out, I'm not sure who the right which one of you is the right person to ask this to, so I'll just throw it out for whoever has thoughts on it. Director Ray yesterday gave a press conference in which he came about as close as I've ever seen somebody in his position doing to say, I'm going to fire some people. He basically said, we've referred a bunch of cases to OPR, and once we go through that process, we won't hesitate to hold people accountable. When you have, leaving aside the Jim Comey question, because that's an individual who's no longer there, who made very individualized actions, but in the months since, you've had the firing of McCabe, you've had the removal of Jim Baker, you've had Strzok and Page who resigns, Strzok, who has presumably now been referred to OPR, and you have this pattern of leaks that the director says very publicly, we're having this investigated and we're referring people to OPR. I'm trying to figure out what the climate that all of this cumulatively creates within the Bureau is, whether it's creating a culture of rule enforcement and in an appropriate way, or whether it's kind of creating a culture in which people feel like they're going to be thrown under the bus, especially because the merits of these cases are so radically different from one another. Who's got thoughts on that? Go for it, Quinta.
Yeah, I'll take it. I mean, I think it's additionally complicated by the fact that this is Director Ray, who is obviously selected by President Trump and who has been really quiet about defending the Bureau in response to the president's attacks. He hasn't, and Kerry was just talking about what McCabe dealt with during his time as acting director. One of the things he did was sit in front of Congress and say, it is not true that the Bureau was in turmoil under Comey. In contrast, Ray has not really done anything like that. And so to the extent that there's a feeling within the Bureau that Ray is sort of not sticking up for them, I do wonder whether there's a sort of a different valence to those statements than there would be if he was coming from a position where people felt that he really was acting in the best interests of the institution as such.
What do you think, Marty? Is you know, given that some of these people have been, you know, Comey is removed, but not for this, not for the reasons that you're upset at him and think he dishonored the institution. He's removed for quite obviously corrupt reasons. McCabe is a very complicated story. Some of these people who've been referred to OPR are clearly people who've, you know, done some things that are, you know, flamboyantly inappropriate. How do you create a norm-respecting, rule-enforcing culture without seeming in this political environment to throw a whole lot of people under the bus who shouldn't be thrown under the bus?
I don't know enough to know whether anyone has been thrown under the bus without reason or inappropriately. And I also don't know what the effect is within an institution like the Bureau when some people are made examples of because of their wrongdoing through various types of sanctions. I do feel strongly, however, that the way to instill these norms and to strengthen them is by example and by doing it the right way, which is what I've been stressing that I think is going on now in the Mueller investigation and was going on among most of the officials who are described at great length in the OIG report. It's really an extraordinary description of people who are calling without fear or favor, without ass covering is not their principal objective. They are willing to, you know, suffer the slings and arrows of politics once they make their decision on the merits without regard to elections, without regard to the media, without regard, at least as a principal consideration, to the reputation of the institution and of themselves, but instead with a principal regard for doing it according to. The rules aren't always correct, but they are presumptively correct. They've been arrived at over a long period of time and have proven their worth for the most part based upon decisions made by a lot of well-meaning people who have been trying to come up with those rules for good reasons, including rules about adhering to lines of authority and demonstrating by example the right way in which this can be done and doing something that the American people can be proud of. I think, I hope, in my own case, has had much greater effect than the interorum effect of particular sanctions against people who do things wrong. I think seeing the people do things the right way without fear or favor and without the obsessive consideration of what will this do to my reputation, what will this do to the reputation of the institution, is both chastening and heartening and instructive. And I hope it will be effective.
And how do you evaluate Chris Ray in this? I mean, you know, he has been, as Quinta points out, notably quiet, both in ways that are, I think, you know, attractive. He's not, you know, he's really being a kind of by the book kind of guy in just the way you describe. But also, you know, Quinta is not wrong that there are a lot of people in that building who, you know, wonder who speaks for them and who's going to stand up for them when the president and Devin Nunes are behaving this way. And the answer right now is nobody. And so how, you know, this was Ray's basically his first press conference yesterday, and it was to say, you know, we're going to enforce our rules against our own people, which is an important message. But I do wonder, can that be the only message? And, you know, what else perhaps should the director have said yesterday?
I mean, my sense is I've been impressed by what I've seen of Chris Ray. I don't know his work that well. He has a very fine reputation. I mean, you and I and others have discussed this at great length, this terrible spot that folks like Ray and Rod Rosenstein, and to a lesser extent Bob Mueller, are in, and to what extent, you know, when the president outrageously attacks the integrity and neutrality of the department, and tries to, you know, to poison the people's view of the intelligence community and of law enforcement, and of a lot of good career and political appointees doing good hard work with integrity. What should they do? You know, one answer is perhaps you come out and you say, my boss, the president of the United States, is saying outrageous things, and I'm behind you, and I think it's unacceptable. At which point you'll probably be removed with all of the uncertainty that that brings with it. Or you could do what they've done and just keep plugging along and doing things the right way and demonstrating the way things ought to be done and giving the investigators and the prosecutors the proper tools to finalize an investigation in a way that will be respected by anyone looking at it fairly. By everyone? No, of course not. We don't live in a world in which anything that can happen in law enforcement or intelligence or in investigation is going to be accepted. But we never have. And I don't know what the right balance is. Sure, like you, Ben, I wish there were a way for the current appointees to stand up for their institutions more than they've been able to. I think the real failing is the former government officials who have been silent, who don't have that balance to be weighing and to be calibrating.
That's a different conversation, but let me bracket it by saying I very much agree with that. Carrie, how do you evaluate the FBI's institutional response, both the one in the document itself, but also Chris Wray's statement and press conference yesterday?
I think Wray has done about as good a job as one could to walk this line that he has to walk in terms of his involvement. You know, the special counsel's investigation operates independently, but it operates with the support of FBI agents. And so there is a role for Chris Wray in that he continues to engage in. He obviously knows that there is some work to do to repair the credibility of the FBI to the extent that these Strzok and Page emails, because they make good headlines, really, I think, have done some damage sort of out in the country to the FBI institutionally. And so if he was talking about anybody facing consequences, I think it was probably directed at individuals, you know, whose communications are detailed in the report, probably Strzok in particular. You mentioned a few people at the outset, Ben, of your question that kind of put all together different individuals who are no longer in their prior positions. And I just want to point out that I think there's a big difference between all of them. So in other words, I would distinguish McCabe's firing and sort of the midnight way that it was done from the handling of however Strzok or other agents who are implicated the way that he is in terms of inappropriate, bringing their inappropriate political beliefs into the workplace in some way. I think those are very distinguishable, and I know you'll agree with me about this, from, for example, the removal you mentioned, Jim Baker, from his position of general counsel, which I don't think had anything to do at all with anything improper, but had to do with simply a new FBI director bringing in their own selection of general counsel, combined with the fact that Jim probably, I don't know this for a fact, but probably is a witness to any type of obstruction investigation that may be conducted with respect to the dismissal of Director Comey. So I think there's a lot of different people who have moved their chairs. I don't think they're all attributable to a cleaning house type environment. And I think also the last thing I'll mention on this is I don't think that Wray's public statement should be interpreted, his press conference yesterday should be interpreted to be the sum total of the work that he's done internally to speak to the workforce and to engage with the FBI workforce. I think that probably has been an ongoing effort of his to engage with them directly since his arrival.
Yeah, so just to be clear, I completely agree with you that the merits of all of these different cases are completely different from one another, which I certainly meant to. And, you know, I also, but I do worry about the cumulative message that a large aggregation of discrete actions involving some of them disciplinary actions, some of them people moving on, some of them, you know, the institution just having different needs at different times, all taking place against in the aftermath of the firing of Jim Comey and in the context of the president tweeting about people often by name. I mean, he's tweeting about Peter Strzok by name today. And, you know, I do worry about the cumulative impact of personnel actions, even if some of them are perfectly justified in the context of that environment. All right, we're about out of time, but I want to get a quick final thought from each of you on the question of, is this over now? Is this finally the end of the discussion of the Clinton emails matter, so to speak? You know, that we have now finished the investigation. We have finished the investigation of the investigation, and now we can actually finally, like, talk about something else? Or is this, you know, coming back somehow, and there are sort of still live threads here that are, you know, going to zombie-like rise up and attack us again? Carrie, what do you think? Are we done?
I think for the community of observers who has been looking to the conclusion of this IG report for clarity about whether or not, in the IG's judgment, the prosecutorial decision on the Hillary Clinton case was appropriately handled, I think it settles that. In terms of political discussion, I think the Hillary Clinton email case will live on like the Whitewater case and other investigations that have sort of captured the political machinations of the government in that way. I mean, I just think we'll hear about it politically probably forever, but I do think that the report closes an important chapter as to the substance of whether the decision making was appropriate or not. And I think the report basically says that it was, but it finds fault in judgment with certain individuals in leadership.
Quinta, what's the read your crystal ball? Are we done with this, or are we going to have a second act?
I think we're going to be reliving the 2016 election until the end of time, frankly. I mean, Carrie is absolutely right that this does sort of close the book on the, you know, sober institutional question of how the investigation was handled. But, I mean, this thing is 500 pages long. There's enough there for as many conspiracy theories as you want to spin. Devin Nunes yesterday, I think, was on Fox complaining about how he hadn't been given a certain of the Strzok paid text messages that showed up in the report beforehand, and seemed like he was spinning himself up to sort of launch another round of his requests to the Justice Department, attempts to force Rosenstein to hand things over. So it seems to me like it's a pretty rich source for people who want to stir up discord, which there are a lot of, even though it does seem to give a pretty definitive answer to the actual questions asked.
Marty, what do you think? We finally done?
So, I mean, any reasonable person would think we're finally done with the question of whether Secretary Clinton violated the law. I mean, one thing that is not being stressed enough in this report is that there was no debate about this among the dozens and dozens of people dealing with it, both in the Department of Justice and in the FBI. This was an easy case of declining prosecution, that it would have been a terrible deviation from history and from practice to do otherwise, in particular because, rightly or wrongly, the folks at the State Department who were sending her these emails and her and she did not realize they contained classified information. There's an interesting backstory there that I'm not sure we'll ever find out about why they didn't think certain things were classified and why others do. But that's it's pretty remarkable. It's not as though this was a close call with people on both sides. There were obviously some agents not involved in the case who got wind of it and who were outraged by it, but who were not part of the investigation, who were leaking suggestions that there was wrongdoing here. So I think that's over. But of course it will be tried to be exploited because we live in a world in which facts don't really matter when it comes to the everyday politics and cable news. But the more important, the object lesson or the really important lessons to draw from it are the potential costs and risks of deviating so broadly from the norms that have been laid down, even if it's only by a few people within the system and within an investigation, that the hubris of thinking that you have a monopoly, even on what will redound to the benefit of the reputation of the FBI, there's no reason. A little humility would be a good thing to keep in mind, because it could be that the rules laid down were laid down for a good reason. And at the very least, you shouldn't take it upon yourself to do what Horowitz calls the ad hoc decision-making here, thinking that no one else and no one within your chain of command could possibly even be worthy of conversation about the questions of whether to deviate from those norms. And what we've seen here, unfortunately, is that the cost of such deviation can be enormous. It may have changed the fate of the country for many decades to come, not because of ill-motivated judgments, but because of a certain hubris that was very unfortunate. And I hope it will be a lesson for what not to do in the future.
We're going to leave it there. Marty Lederman, Quinta Jurecic, Carrie Cordero, thank you all for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is, as ever, produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. I know you thought I was going to surprise you there with a different think tank, but it's always the Brookings Institution. Listen, if you're one of those many people who listens to the Lawfare Podcast and has not yet rated us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or whatever podcast distribution service you use, you are a free rider and you need to stop free riding. So get on it and do it. And while you're doing that, tweet this episode of the Lawfare Podcast and tell people you listen to it. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan. And thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.